Welcome everyone. Absolutely delighted that so many people were able to make it along tonight. I'm particularly excited to be introducing our speaker this evening and for this book launch. It's a project that I've taken a very, very close interest in from the earliest stage, and it really dates back, I think, to when Andrea approached us to publish a paper as part of our Lisi series, and it was absolutely fantastic. The trouble was it was about five times longer than anything we could hope to publish. And so I was left with the situation of saying, you can shorten it, which would be a dreadful shame, because there is so much information here and so much interesting anecdotal information as well. Or else you could go back and extend it and produce a book. And really, I think there is so much here that would be brilliant to add to our understanding of what's happened in Kosovo. You add such an interesting dimension to it as somebody who's been on the coalface of policymaking in Kosovo, that it would be a real shame to have to leave out a lot of this. And I was absolutely delighted that Andrea actually then said, well, you know what, I'll give it a go. I mean, it's a bit of a tough task to say to anyone, look, you know, how about going for the book? But I think absolutely to see it now published like this is wonderful. And I think, you know, the other thanks that obviously goes for this is to IB Taurus and their decision to take this on. I remember I have a close cooperation with IB Taurus. I've published a number of books with them myself, and always had a fantastic time of publishing with them, and know that they have this strong interest in policy-related books as well as academic books, and so felt that they'd be absolutely perfect for this. And they, thankfully, I think, were very keen as well to see this. So I think today this really is, you know, I'm terribly pleased that we are in this situation to have this now published. By way of background, our speaker this evening, Andrea Lorenzo Capusella, has a PhD on competition policy and is a lawyer by training. After a few years in the private sector, he served as the head of the economics unit of Kosovo's international supervisor, the International Civilian Office, in 2008 to 2011. And then as advisor to Moldova's economy minister and deputy prime minister on behalf of the EU. By way of background, the book abstract reads as follows. The West went to war for Kosovo, administered it for 9 years, made it independent, supervised it for 4 years, and gave it unprecedented amounts of aid. The aim was to erect a stable and well-governed democracy. The outcome is a poor, ill-governed, and still fragile state, threatening Europe's internal security and stability of the Balkans. The question why the most ambitious state-building intervention ever attempted by the West has largely failed has not been posed. This book offers an answer that moves from the literature on state-building and economic development, draws on the author's own experience, and takes a perspective of the interests of the European Union. Although Kosovo evokes ethnic conflict and territorial disputes, the origin of the threats it now poses to Europe's interests lies in the defective quality of its democracy. Exploiting its weaknesses, a predatory elite could capture the new state and subvert its political and economic institutions to entrench itself. Corruption, organized crime, and election fraud are the most visible manifestations of the inefficient and unequal social order that has emerged, which is the root cause of such threats and has deepened Kosovo's acute socio-economic problems, as the recent exodus of its citizens attests. The reasons for this outcome include the design flaws, policy mistakes, and lack of accountability of the state-building missions deployed in Kosovo, the weaknesses of the European common foreign and security policy, divergences between the EU and the United States, and above all, disregard for the democratic principles. I noticed earlier today that Tim Judah apologised for not being here, but obviously said this is an incredibly important book. Andrea.
Thank you so much, James, for this very kind introduction. I'm very grateful to you and to the Institute for inviting me to present this book. Here is Kosovo, actually, down there. You see the small landlocked state. It's maybe a quarter of the area of Switzerland, hosts 1.8 million people and has, frankly, little economic or strategic interest. Yet, despite its modest attractions, this territory has been the theater of, as James mentioned, the most intensive, ambitious, and also expensive state-building intervention ever launched. Here are a few numbers. As you can see, in per capita terms, 19 times the average developing country, 6 times the average Balkan country. This is, in fact, a number drawn from figures we have about the recent years, because in previous years we don't have very accurate data. If we include that, it could, this number could go up to 8 or even 10. Quite strikingly, 50 times more troops and 25 times more money than Afghanistan in the immediate aftermath of the war. To give you an idea of the aggregate amounts, in per capita terms, the flow of money that went into Kosovo was broadly similar per person to the current average monthly wage. And if we extrapolate, well, these are the, this is some numbers on the aggregate. Anyway, maybe we can skip quickly. The only this is to give you an idea. These numbers are not very accurate because before 2009 we don't have very very accurate figures on the amount of aid that went into Kosovo. Now, the reason why this piece of land received so much attention and so much investment is linked, it seems to me, to the politics of the crisis of Kosovo, which has left a far deeper and more lasting influence on the evolution of international relations than the other wars in the Balkans. I refer, naturally, mainly to the two crucial passages of the crisis of Kosovo: the Western decision to intervene militarily in 1999 and its decision to grant, effectively, allow Kosovo to become independent in 2008. These two decisions were very controversial because they were taken without the authorization of the Security Council of the UN, let alone the consent of the titular sovereign, the government in Belgrade. The motivation of these two decisions were mainly concerns for justice, we can say, protection of the human rights of the Kosovo population, which was the subject of very violent wave of repression by the Milosevic regime, and later concerns about the political liberties of the population of Kosovo. But these decisions have also had the effect, objectively, of challenging the authority of the Security Council, challenging the protection, the prohibition against the use of force, challenging the principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity of states. In the book, and here, I would like to remain neutral in respect of these choices. I don't want to say whether they were good or bad, legitimate or illegitimate. What matters from the perspective of analyzing the state-building intervention is that these choices were very controversial and have had this effect on the evolution of international relations. As I said, these two choices have touched fundamental questions concerning the relative importance of justice and order in international relations. And they touched also the question as to the capacity of international law to constrain the choices of the dominant actors. Both choices went in the sense of weakening such constraints and expanding the freedom of action of the dominant powers. I needn't remind you that the height of the Kosovo crisis broadly coincides with the high point of the so-called unipolar moment of the U.S. And indeed, it is at the behest of the U.S. government that these choices were taken. These choices were, in one word, were probably part of an effort to reshape international relations in the post-war, in the post-Cold War era. The Kosovo precedents have been mentioned often in the narrative about the intervention in Iraq, more lately by Moscow in relation to what they did in Georgia in 2008, in the Crimea more recently. Because these two choices were controversial, and in order to strengthen their value as precedents to grant greater freedom of action to the dominant powers and to the US in particular, one argument that was used to justify them was also of a consequentialist nature. The West said to its own domestic constituencies and to international public opinion that it was necessary to intervene, and especially it was necessary to grant Kosovo independence, because this, and only this, would have allowed Kosovo to evolve into a prosperous, open democracy. So this consequentialist argument has had the effect of charging the state-building intervention also of the function of retrospectively justifying those controversial choices. This is, if you like, the point I would like to highlight for the purposes of then interpreting the evolution of the state-building intervention. So besides the material needs of Kosovo, which were considerable, but not much greater than those of Bosnia, and certainly smaller than those of Iraq and Afghanistan, and indeed because Kosovo is in Europe, this is all these considerations about the politics of the evolution of international relations do explain, I think, in large measure why such investment went into Kosovo. The state-building intervention evolved into two distinct phases. The first, which began after the end of the conflict in the summer of 1999 and lasted until the declaration of independence in February 2008. During this phase, Kosovo was administered by the United Nations as effectively a protectorate. The United Nations had all powers of government in Kosovo. The second phase begins with the declaration of independence and effectively continues to this day. Kosovo still hosts a large and still rather powerful EU mission, which is active in the rule of law sector. The book covers both, although it devotes more attention to the second phase. Here I would propose to talk only of the second phase, because less has been written about it, and also because I think it is a more interesting case study, if you like. It is more interesting mainly because independence removed two significant obstacles to state building in the previous phase. The first was uncertainty about the status of Kosovo. The UN was building political institutions without knowing whether they would become sovereign ones or simply the means to ensure the internal self-determination of the people of Kosovo. The second obstacle is that independence finally removed what had been an important proximate cause of the crisis of Kosovo, namely ethnic tensions and the conflict between the majority Albanian population of Kosovo and the governments in Belgrade. Statehood was contested, of course, but it was immediately clear that the independence of Kosovo was politically irreversible. And when Kosovo became independent, it was the most ethnically homogeneous state in Europe, together with Albania. The majority Albanian population numbers something like 93-94% of the population. The Serb minority is about 4%, or perhaps even less. There are probably more Roma than Serbs in Kosovo by now. So Kosovo. For all these reasons, Kosovo was probably an ideal experiment in state building by reason of the vast investment that went into it, because the West had a strong political interest in the success of the state building intervention, and because Kosovo society was pacified, stable. There were no ethnic or deep ethnic or political cleavages dividing the population. In fact, the population wholeheartedly embraced the liberal economic and political institutions brought by the state-building mission. The aims of the population and the aims of the state builder were, in fact, aligned. The population of Kosovo desired nothing more than integration into the European Union and into NATO. There were two problems, however. The first problem is that the interests of the Western powers were not fully aligned. After 2001, after international terrorism became an issue, after Iraq, Afghanistan, and all what happened after, Kosovo gradually went down the list of the foreign policy priorities of Washington, entirely legitimately so, of course. So I think that especially in the second phase, for Washington, what mattered the most in Kosovo was to prove that the state building, well, to ensure a degree of success of the state building intervention in order to retrospectively justify those controversial decisions, but not much more than that. For the European Union and for European capitals instead, the long-term stability and development of Kosovo are an important priority. The Balkans are usually called the backyard of Europe. Kosovo is a, although rather small territory, has a central importance in the stability of the region, and indeed its uncertain status was viewed as the last real obstacle to the final stabilization of the Balkans. So the interests of Washington and the European capitals were not fully aligned. Their influence in Kosovo was also not aligned. Namely, the US had far more influence than the Europeans in Kosovo, not just because the US is a stronger global actor than the EU in general, but also because precisely because it was mainly Washington that pushed for those two decisions. Well, the perception is that the population in Kosovo is still very grateful to the US, rightly so in a way, and well, if in doubt, they tend to listen more to the Americans than to Europeans. This misalignment between the interest and the influence of the main Western powers will, I hope to show later, will be a rather important factor. Now, I would propose to place ourselves sometime between the summer of 2007 and the spring of 2008, when the Western decision to allow Kosovo to become independent crystallized, and when the West had to decide whether or not, and if so, in what form, to continue the state-building intervention. I will try to describe the conditions of Kosovo in that period, the decisions taken by the West, the rationale and the design of the second phase of the state-building intervention, in order then to discuss its results and reach some conclusions. Now, the UN did not do very well during the 9 years of its protectorate. In 2008, Kosovo was still the poorest country of the Balkans, also the poorest of Europe, together with Moldova, and was the country where governance was worst, despite all the investment we just mentioned. I have here a few, well, the main macroeconomic indicators. Kosovo always was the poorest province of Yugoslavia. During the UN protectorate, as you can see, the gap that separated Kosovo from its neighbors, its neighbors widened even. Kosovo grew at, well, I take the last years, the initial years' growth is in fact distorted by the huge amount of money that went into initial reconstruction. So if we look at these years, Kosovo grew at about 4%. The rest of the region grew at 2.2 percentage points more. What we should really look at, however, by reason of the high natality rate in Kosovo, is per capita growth, which was much slower, 2.5%. Kosovo did not, as you can see, did not invest in its productive capacity. Neither the public sector nor the private sector invested a lot. As you can see, investment was stagnant. And we see the signs of a very unproductive economy in the very large current account balance. Kosovo, in fact, exported very little except migrant labor, imported lots of what it consumed. The private sector was very small and largely informal. Estimates vary, but we can assume that about half of economic activity was informal. The formal sector was either large formerly state-owned businesses or a lot of services mainly geared to domestic consumption, which produced no exports and where the margins for productivity growth are very small. The gap in the balance of payments was covered by aid, as you can see in that period was still receiving quite a lot, by remittances from migrants and a bit of foreign investment, but not very much. This economy failed to give either jobs or good incomes to the population. Poverty and unemployment were both at about 45%. Extreme poverty was between 15 and 20%. Extreme poverty means not having an income that guarantees to you the enough calories to lead a healthy life. And youth unemployment was as high as 75%. If we turn to the political system, the analysis by the European Commission and by other institutions describe a society in which political accountability was very low, the checks and balances system was ineffective, civil society was weak, independent media were few, and the rule of law especially was very weak. And in this society, corruption, organized crime, and illegality more in general, were widespread. Estimates dating from 2009 suggest that the turnover of organized crime in Kosovo was somewhere between one quarter and two thirds of GDP. Two thirds, by the way, is drawn from undisclosed EU reports quoted by the literature on Kosovo, dating from 2009. Two thirds of GDP. Corruption was widespread, both petty and political corruption. It affected the judiciary too. In the first chapter of the book, I tried to describe the literature I used to make sense of all this data I gave you, and to draw a picture of the governance system that underpins all these problems and created them. I will not go into this literature, which is mainly drawn from institutional economics and the political economy of development. I'll try to give you the in very simplified form, my own two main conclusions. The governance system that is at the roots of all these problems, or social order, as I often call it in the book, following that literature, was shaped mainly by the power and the interests of the political-economic elite of Kosovo. And the second conclusion is that this governance system was very stable. It was an equilibrium because, if you like, all the forces present in Kosovo society were composed rather harmoniously. This was a stable system. Where did the power of this elite come from? The original sin of state building in Kosovo, in my view, was the failure to disarm and disband the guerrilla units of the Kosovo Liberation Army that fought against Milosevic. This is a controversial issue. One may wonder whether it was at all possible to disarm them. I think that over time it was. The UN and NATO failed to do that. So the military elite at the time was able to gradually transform their own military power into political and economic power, and then also social power. They acquired assets, resources, established political parties, patronage networks. Thanks to the considerable concentration of power, political and economic power, they managed to acquire, they succeeded in, on one hand, subverting the formal political and economic institutions that the UN was building, and protecting their established position from both political and economic competition. And they managed to launch the roots of their power deep into Kosovo society through vast patronage networks, which solidified their political machinery and their social support. This system was stable because the various factions into which the elite was organized, factions which included, for instance, a political party or a segment of a political party, maybe a newspaper, and then businesses or friendly businessmen. Then there were the criminal operations, because I forgot to say that this politico-economic elite partly coincides with the criminal elite of Kosovo. And then there were the men with guns, or the men able to take guns and to act, which were, I think, the primary foundation of the power of these factions. These various factions, of course, competed against each other on the distribution of the rents, mainly economic rents, that this governance system could guarantee. But they share an interest in maintaining this system stable, maintaining this governance system stable. So their competition would never reach a point that would imperil the stability of the system. This system, of course, benefited a minority, a tiny minority indeed, of the citizens. Yet ordinary citizens could not do anything about it, in my view, because it was individually rational for them to accept this governance system. And it was individually rational for every citizen to accept this governance system because they lacked intermediate organizations existing between the electorate and the political authorities that could help them overcome the obstacles to collective action, could help them organize in order to demand greater political and economic opportunities and in order to assert their rights. And these intermediate organizations did not exist because, acting strategically, I think, the elite had controlled the main political parties and had effectively captured the main trade unions and some civil society organizations. So the citizens lacked institutions that could organize them. And of course, acting alone was de facto impossible. They did not have a chance in front of this system. In this situation, it was individually rational for them to become part of one of these patronage networks or to accept petty corruption in order to gain the little benefits or privileges that this could allow, such as a job in the public sector or a license, maybe in exchange for a bribe. To put it in one word, in such a system, it became rational for citizens to trade their rights as citizens against favors. Which is, by the way, something that can be said also about parts of southern Italy, where I come from, which is also why I found it easier, in a way, to understand Kosovo than my French, German, or English colleagues in the mission. I saw something which I sounded broadly familiar to what I saw. I am going too slow, but I'll try. The last reason why this governance system emerged and became rather stable, also by reason of the choices of the UN mission. I will not discuss what they did and why they did so in particular, because what I will say about the other two missions that follow them will be valid also for the UN mission. But the UN mission effectively limited itself to writing good laws for Kosovo and neglecting their implementation. It devolved gradually lots of its powers to representative political institutions established through elections, but it retained direct control over most of the checks and balances system. It still controlled the higher levels of the judiciary, the electoral process, the central bank, the economic regulators, the media commissioner. However, it it used its control over these institutions not to enforce the law on the elite and to hold it in check, but rather to force the elite to negotiate with it in order to tame the worst excesses of the elite and in order to guarantee a modicum of order, superficial stability, a superficial appearance of progress, which is what was necessary for Washington and some other capitals to show the world that, you know, Kosovo was doing well. This, in this sense, unwittingly, I think, the UN mission became effectively assisted the elite in establishing its power, because the elite became the only representative of the polity, which, by the way, subverted the notion of local ownership, which was behind a lot of the approach. Now, if this was the situation in 2008, it was clear then, in my view, that Kosovo, upon its independence, Kosovo risked what is generally known as state capture. Namely, as the UN mission would leave Kosovo and would also relinquish control over those remaining independent institutions, the elite was likely to immediately take control of them because Kosovo lacked sufficiently strong endogenous forces to act as a countervailing force to the power of the elite. And had this happened, the governance system I described would have simply crystallized and solidified, and it would have been a very long-term prospect to imagine an evolution into a more open society. So the question facing the West ahead of the independence of Kosovo was more or less this. It would have made sense to continue the state-building intervention only if the West was able and willing to shape an intervention such as to prevent state capture and reverse the evolution of the social order of Kosovo, of this governance system, in a direction of greater openness and you know, the rule of law and all that. It was clear, however, that doing that would have been very difficult, because the UN had failed to do it, so there was a precedent, and because over those 9 years, the power of the elite had grown. And the elite had grown to expect that the international community would not entrench, encroach over its main interests. The first attempts to enforce the law on the criminal operations of the elite would probably have sparked a retaliation, because the elite was likely to judge this as a kind of aberration in respect of past practice. So it was by no, if we look at it a bit with the benefit of hindsight, but not so much, it was not at all obvious that it would have made sense to organize a second phase of the state-building intervention, because it was very difficult. It would have required to do things which the UN had not been able to do. The West decided to continue the state-building intervention and designed it, I think, very well. I think the decision is due to the fact that, again, they had to justify their decision, controversial decision, to grant to Kosovo independence, so they wanted to stay. And on the part of Europe, I think there was the intention of using the opportunity offered by the, if you like, controversial independence of Kosovo as an occasion for fixing Kosovo's governance problems, which would have helped fixing the governance and criminality problems in the Balkans, strengthening its stability, protecting the internal security of the EU, which are the markets that are targeted by the criminal circles in the Balkans, of course, are in the EU. But I think the EU also wanted to prove in Kosovo the effectiveness of its common foreign policy and its credibility as a global actor. I think all this explains why the West chose to continue the intervention and also why it chose to intervene very heavily. The West deployed two missions in Kosovo, a large European rule of law mission named EULEX, which has by now cost more than €1 billion. At peak, it employed three times as many officials as the dozen other EU missions combined. It had between 2,000 and 3,000 officials, and it had an unprecedented mandate. Besides an advisory function, it had the so-called executive powers. Their judges and prosecutors and policemen were entitled to arrest, judge, send to jail those responsible of the main crimes, corruption, organized crime, war crimes. This is unprecedented. Next to this mission, the West, let's say, because only the West in this vague notion can be regarded as the political masters of this mission, created a political supervisor for Kosovo, which is the mission where I was working, the International Civilian Office, whose function was that of overseeing the implementation of the blueprint for Kosovo's independence, the Atizari plan. But in a nutshell, this mission had, thanks to almost unlimited corrective powers, the mission could dismiss any public official in Kosovo and annul laws or governmental decisions. In a nutshell, this mission was there, in my view, chiefly to protect the checks and balances system. Then it also had the functions on the protection of minorities and decentralization, but I will not talk about this because I think these are rather marginal issues. Maybe we can return to that if you have questions, but I will, for now, leave them aside. I said that this intervention was well designed because, in my view, the mandate, resources, and powers of these missions were targeted to the crucial weaknesses in Kosovo. The rule of law, taken care of by ULEX, and the weakness of the checks and balances system, for which the International Civilian Office could be a guardian and a source of strength. So, how did these two missions perform? I will, this is the main part of the book, but I will just try to go through very quickly a few graphs. These are drawn from the World Bank's World Governance Indicators. These are, in fact, synthetic indicators. They join together all available indicators about the governance in the country in question, and draw this kind of meta indicator. Until 2007, the vertical axis gives you the absolute, if you like, the absolute quality of governance, in this case the rule of law, and it goes from -2.5 up to +2.5. But the absolute level, I think, is not very relevant. What is interesting to see is the trend, the evolution over time, and the gaps between the various countries. Kosovo is at the bottom. This is Kosovo. Until 2007, the indicator is not particularly reliable because it is based only on 1 to 3 underlying indicators. From 2007 on, it is far more reliable because it is based on 7 or 9, I can't remember exactly, underlying indicators. Indicators such as those produced by Transparency International, the World Bank itself, Economist Intelligence Unit, Bertelsmann Foundation, Freedom House, these things. I think these are the most reliable, if you like, synthetic analysis of the quality of governance. As you can see, rule of law improved until 2008, and upon independence, when the rule of law sector came into the hands of ULEX, the EU Rule of Law Mission, we see stagnation. It went down, up a little bit, but the position in 2013, which is the latest data available, is not statistically different from the position in 2008. This despite the expenditure of €1 billion in the EU mission. Control of corruption, as you can see, until 2007, rather unsteady path, probably largely explained by the fact that few observations were made. But from 2008, again, stagnation, in fact, marginal decline. Namely, corruption has probably risen under the tutorship of ULEX. This observation, by the way, is supported by a lot of anecdotal evidence, some of which I saw myself, and lots of other analysis. Even more importantly, voice and accountability. This is an indicator that measures more or less the extent to which political authorities are exposed to pressure from the electorate and the extent to which society has a chance to make its voice heard by the political authorities. As you can see, there is a jump here between 2008 and 2009, but the reason, of course, is that Kosovo became independent. It was a protectorate, which was almost a colonial setting, and it acquired political independence. So voice and accountability went up for this conceptual reason. Since then, steep decline. And here, as in the other graphs, as you can see, Kosovo is the lowest in the region. It is lower even than Bosnia, which is the red line with the squares just above it, which is indicative. Bosnia is there because its political institutions are simply structurally flawed. They are the product of the Dayton Peace Agreement, which was not about constitutional engineering, it was about ending the war. Kosovo ranks even lower than Bosnia. These three graphs, I think, depict what we can only call failure on the part of both missions, ULEX and the International Civilian Office, where I worked. Failure, more generally, of the Western attempt to create, as I said, a prosperous and well-governed democracy in Kosovo. I will not go through this except to say that Kosovo's economy did not improve a lot since then, despite a further big flow of aid. As you can see, real growth grew by 0.1%. The gap between Kosovo and its neighbor narrowed down, but only because its neighbors collapsed by reason of the economic crisis. Kosovo was untouched by the economic crisis because it is entirely isolated from the rest of the global economy. It exports nothing. Its debt is not traded in the capital markets. It doesn't have its own currency. So effectively, there were no channels through which the crisis could reach Kosovo. There was quite a lot of investment, but by reason of corruption and mistaken, I think, economic policies, little of that was really useful for increasing the productive capacity of the economy. You see that in the widening current account balance, which depicts an even more unproductive economy. To give you an example of bad investments, Kosovo spent 25% of GDP for an infrastructure project that lacks any real economic rationale, a highway to Albania. I have not misspoken, 25% of GDP. I can go more into this later. On the vertical axis you have the amount of aid received by these the countries of the Balkans as a percentage of their gross national income. On the horizontal axis you have life expectancy. Let me show you these correlations. Kosovo, which is that diamond up there, received, as you can see, six times as much aid in the past years than its neighbors, and yet Kosovars live between 4 and 7 years less than their neighbors on average. In particular, they live 7 years less than the Albanians, their fellow Albanians. I think this is rather striking, and 7 years out of an average life of 70 is quite a lot. Why? And by the way, I use life expectancy as a proxy for the quality of life in Kosovo. This, unfortunately, is the only data, is the only thing for which we have data that are comparable for the whole region and for a sufficient number of years. These are, in fact, averages of the period between 2008 and 2012, for which we have data. How was it possible? I'll show you a couple of other graphs on possible explanations. Here we have, in the same structure, life expectancy against one governance indicator, rule of law. As you can see, again, Kosovo is down there. As you can see, there is a rather neat line going up like this, which suggests a causal correlation. The quality of life is lowest where governance is worst. And this is rather intuitive. Bad governance typically is a tax on the citizens, a hidden tax on the citizens, especially on the poorest, because they received comparatively worse public services, including health services. And the correlation is relatively strong. It is confirmed if we look at voice and accountability. Now, the plots are a bit more dispersed, but as you can see, anyway, Kosovo remains far below the other ones. And this is a more relevant indicator because, indeed, in voice and accountability is where, you know, the population would be able, you know, to demand better services. If voice and accountability is low, services tend to be worse. And then there is another correlation which I think is quite interesting, and which is an indictment of the state building missions. Correlation between governance and aid. Why didn't aid bring benefits to Kosovo? Well, because governance was very bad. There is a theory in the literature about the political economy of development, whereby where governance is bad, large amount of aids are likely to further worsen governance standards. For two main reasons. First, large flows of aid increase incentive to retain power at all costs by the existing elite, because, of course, control of power will mean the ability to divert part of those flows of aid. The second reason is that a lot of aid reduces a government's dependence from taxation, from tax income. And depending on taxation, of course, is, on one hand, an indirect source of political accountability. And on the other hand, taxation is an incentive to both improve governance to improve economic growth in order to expand the tax base, and to improve governance in order to improve tax collection, in order to increase tax revenues. If you don't have to rely on taxation and can rely on a lot of aid, of course, your incentive to improve governance weakens. And we can see it very clearly here. This is plotted against rule of law, and the same is true if we plot it against voice and accountability. So the bad performance of the two missions and of the UN before was such that not only they failed to give Kosovo what the West promised to them, namely a good and prosperous democracy, but they also allowed a lot of the aid provided to Kosovo by the West to frankly go to waste. I was intending to say something about these frescoes by Lorenzetti in Siena, which depict good and bad government. This is good government and this is bad government. I will just say that in good government, here you have justice, rather cruel kind of justice. Here they're chopping the head of a person. But justice, if you like, is separated from the ruler and ensures a degree of order and social cohesion, as you can see. You know, the citizens are peaceful and, you know. In bad government, justice is here. She's at the feet of the ruler, bound up and held by a chain. And the ruler is tyranny, and you have all the other allegories. You know, this was clear to Ambrogio Lorenzetti and to the citizens of Siena in the 14th century. It was not very clear to the management of Eulex. they would have benefited, you know, to go and visit Siena, because if you have good government, you have a beautiful city built like this, and a beautiful countryside where ladies go for walks. Whereas if you have bad government, your city crumbles and the countryside lies in ruins with houses burning, enemies arriving, and all this. Anyway, aside from that, let's leave good government. To conclude very briefly, why did the missions, the two missions and state building intervention in general, achieve so unsatisfactory results? I think the reasons are mainly the reasons are linked both to the missions and to their political masters. There were structural defects and conceptual errors in these missions. Structural defects, and they are linked. Structural defects in these missions is essentially one. There was very weak accountability inside these missions, and they were subject to very weak oversight by their headquarters or political masters. This bred negligence. Incompetence was allowed to continue, but also allowed the management of these missions to act opportunistically. They were not being watched, and they always chose the easiest path. There were also conceptual errors, I think largely ascribable to these missions and to those who designed them. To cut it short, I think disregard for the democratic principle. I will give you just one small example. My own mission, the ICO, had Kosovo had to adopt a lot of laws right after independence to cover a various sector which the UN had not covered. You know, you need a law on the foreign ministry, a law on state-owned companies, and in order to show that Kosovo was doing well, Western embassies and my own mission and the elite of Kosovo decided that these more or less 50 laws had to adopt it quickly. And they designed a speedy procedure by which Parliament could adopt these laws in the space of 2.5 months without even reading them. 50 laws were approved by Kosovo's government, by Kosovo's Parliament, in a situation in which the members of Parliament really had not a chance to read the laws before voting on them. And this was designed because had they had the chance of reading them, they might have raised objections to this clause or that article. So the texts of these laws were discussed between us, the government, the American embassy, and then for what concerns me, the IMF and the World Bank. I have to admit, I was part of this exercise. It was the early stages, and I was still unaware of all these problems I'm telling you about. Now, if the international intervention was intended to establish democracy in Kosovo, well, that was not a very good example. Especially if, in parallel, the international community was trying to strengthen the parliament in order to strengthen the separation of powers, which was not really very strong in Kosovo. Another example, I have to say, in 2010 there were general elections. Fraud was so vast and so visible that a European ambassador admitted to me on the day after the elections that fraud had been on an industrial scale. The same expression was used 3 years later by another European ambassador, the English ambassador, by the way, in public comments about subsequent elections. These election fraud, according to reliable estimates, affected the allocation of as much as one-third of the seats in parliament. And as I said, fraud was very visible. I talk about it at length in the book. The International Civilian Office did not say anything more about these elections and that fraud than that the elections had been peaceful and constructive. It studiously avoided pronouncing itself on whether they had been free and fair as well. And one can agree that they were peaceful because nobody died in the process of voting, and they were constructive because they did produce a parliament, but not the parliament that the electorate wanted. It's like a different one by one-third. So much for disregard for the democratic principle. I think there were also a deep failure to appreciate the constraints posed to the state building intervention by the political economy of Kosovo, by reason of the governance system that had emerged after the protectorate. And then more in general, there was excessive reliance on the writing of good laws, constitutional engineering, establishing good formal institutions, and then neglecting the way in which they functioned, and even an incoherent and fragmentary approach to constitutional engineering. They would forget bits of the important institution and so on. All this, of course, is partly conceptual error, partly the effect of negligence or incompetence, which were allowed by weak accountability. However, all this was possible because the missions, because the political masters of the mission in Washington and in Brussels and in the other European capitals were not united in guiding these missions, precisely because of the misaligned interests and influence I mentioned before. I will not. What I would just underline two lessons I think I would like to draw from this case. First, no matter how much you invest, it makes little sense to organize a state-building intervention unless you are willing to confront the elite. In the case of Kosovo, it's quite clear, which is often a large part of the problem you are trying to address. There is, of course, a dilemma. You have to deal with the elite and with the government in place in order to do something, but you also have to be willing to undermine the unhealthy basis of their power. It is, I admit, difficult to strike the right balance between the two. In Kosovo, the balance was way too tilted in favor of dealing with the elite. Second, especially ULEX would not have performed so badly had the machinery of the foreign policy in Brussels been itself more accountable and subject to greater oversight. For instance, 4 years have passed before anything was done to improve the performance of ULEX. This shows that accountability and oversight were weak in Brussels too. And one last brief comment. Unless these two problems are resolved, I do not see how similarly ambitious state-building interventions can really succeed. Imagine that Russian aggression ends and that stability returns to Ukraine. What this country will need, above all, from the West, and especially from the EU, will be assistance in improving its political and economic institutions in order to avoid yet another relapse into oligarchic rule as it happened after the Orange Revolution in 2004. If the European Union will not solve these problems, I really do not see how it can meaningfully assist this country. And by the way, we don't have just an idealist intention to improve governance in Ukraine. There is also, I think, a strong geopolitical interest. One needn't be a starry-eyed liberal in order to say that doing that would be useful. Also, a realist would agree. Yet, as I said, as things stand today, I don't think that one can be very optimistic about the prospect of a state-building attempt in Ukraine. I hope that the lesson of Kosovo will be drawn. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrea. We now have about 25 minutes for questions. I'll open the floor. Bernard.
I'm not going to talk about pensions. I was actually interested by your closing remarks because, I mean, if there are implications for Ukraine and what might happen then. I mean, what you described, you also started to describe at the very beginning when you talked about Afghanistan. So, I mean, exactly the same failures. You could have always told the same story, and just sort of changed the name of the country. So, I wonder whether you could comment on these wider implications. Why have we failed to learn? It's not just we haven't learned in Kosovo, and they're going to go and make the same mistakes that in Ukraine that possibly didn't go there. Just one other, this is more of a comment. I mean, you put up a number of graphs with some correlations on, and you were kind of fairly careful about sort of describing them as correlations and not causalities necessarily, and I kept on reversing the axes on them. But the other thing which struck me about them was that Kosovo was an extraordinary outlier in just about every case, so that actually sort of even fitting curved lines into it often didn't work, and I then wondered whether the indicators themselves were actually particularly robust and actually be terribly helpful with respect to Kosovo.
Do you want to take that, or should we take it?
As you like.
Well, maybe address.
Yes. On Ukraine, I mean, Iraq and Afghanistan, I don't know so much, but in a way it is understandable that the West would content itself with establishing a modicum of order, which it probably failed to do, but it is understandable that greater attention was devoted to Kosovo and greater investment, whether because Kosovo is in Europe and so on. What I find most striking in the aspect you underline is that in relative terms, of course Kosovo now fares much better than Afghanistan or Iraq or even Libya, but in relative terms, the scale of the failure of the intervention is similar. If you compare the potential and the investment that went into it, in fact, I think the failure in Kosovo is, if you like, of a bigger size than and of a bigger relevance.
But
than
the question is a modicum of order, which is what, you know, if that's the objective, if, as opposed to something rather more ambitious, revert to that phrase, I think it's important.
But the aim was not a modicum of order, and One doesn't need to be an idealist to say that it was necessary to go beyond establishing a modicum of order, because also for good realist reasons, realpolitik reasons, especially the EU had an interest in going beyond the modicum of order and establishing, a solid and stable, maybe still poor, but maybe still defective, but a solid and stable democracy in Kosovo. And I think this will be even more true in respect of Ukraine, where, however, the job will be far more difficult because there is Putin on the other side of the border, which was not true in Kosovo. On the question of the correlation, because I didn't want to use the causality word because I think the basis is too narrow and too weak. I do not think, however, that the indicators in respect of Kosovo are any less reliable than those for the other countries. They are, in fact, the same sources and the same number of... Often there are less in Kosovo, but in the last years, no. I mean, for the previous years, yes, there were less observations in respect of Kosovo. But for the last years, not really. And they are, in fact, underlying indicators of the same quality of those that are used for the other countries.
So they imply very strong tipping points. There's actually some point where you tip into good from bad. That's what I mean about lines which kind of are not going in straight lines, but they're taking a sharp curve or something.
Yeah.
You tip into something.
Yeah.
Once you have got over some minimal level, you seem to tip into something better.
Yeah, true. But this problem should be avoided by the fact that this indicator mixes many sub-indicators together. I would agree with you. Freedom House, for instance, says you're either free or partly free or not free. And it takes a little bit to move from one category to the other, and that changes a lot. But if Freedom House is one of 7 or 8 or 9 indicators you use, that effect is, I think, a bit diluted.
And one for the wine afterwards, I think. There are rather a lot of questions now. Aaron from the Embassy of Kosovo in London.
Hi. Just let me say from the outset, I haven't read your book, unfortunately. Just out of sheer curiosity for a social researcher myself, I would have loved to read it. But based on what you've said, I would like, if I may very quickly, just...
Yes, of course, absolutely.
...very quick remarks. I just outline, starting from the decision to intervene, I'm not going to enter into theoretical debates, whether, you know, but let me just say that to those starry-eyed idealist, liberal idealists, which I don't know if you ascribe yourself to that sort of like well-meaning liberal left, I think the answer would have been liberal interventions by Lawrence Friedman. I'm not going to go further into that. But from a neuralist perspective, we can also justify the decision to intervene in Kosovo in order to stop the ethnic cleansing and the attempted genocide. Now, when we talk about independence, you always mention the contested sort of like this of independence. You were part, very much part of the process, actually just, I don't know, I can't remember that when you joined the mission, but as you know, there was a UN-led, international-led process, negotiation process, dialogue, where spearheaded by Martti Ahtisaari, and he recommended independence as the only viable solution. That was, in those talks, Russia was always part up to the very last moment, and they withdrew their support when they didn't like what was being recommended. So, and we always, all the recognitions that we've received so far have been based on that uniqueness, sui generis. So, when you draw some sort of like similarities with some of the present crises, geopolitical crisis, I think you should be careful, because they can't draw any similarities between Crimea, no matter what circles want you to draw attention to. Then you mentioned Kosovo was a very good, but strongly was an ideal case for political economic experimentation. And then you go through to
for state building intervention.
UN, yes, after the intervention. But I would also like to say something to all those cynical paralingual voices that I heard from part of the audience here when it was mentioned that Kosovo was poor and a few exports. You have to remember that we went through a great period of political, economic, and social transformations after the war. The war left Kosovo devastated with a moribund economy. That's why we had to start way behind from our neighbors. Obviously, political elites are a product of a society. Kosovo society doesn't differ much from the regions. Corruption is everywhere, so I know you have a loop, and we are some of the highest monitored state and states in the region, and we are being evaluated under a very strict criteria, which we actually, you know, we have nothing against you. So, but you can't obviate with political elites. You have to deal with them, whatever they are, and that's why we have those elites that we have, and we are working very hard towards making progress. But this might actually answer your question a little bit as well. But the statistics are not very reliable when it comes to Kosovo. For many reasons, which I don't have to go time into that, but you have to, a lot of money went to waste, some lavish wages of all those expensive missions. A lot of money wasn't diverted to, spend wisely. You mentioned highway. Let me just make one point. It might not be commercially viable in the short term. It's not, but it has geopolitical relevances for our nation. Compare this to the Hollywood of antiquity experimented in Macedonia, the huge project. You can't compare it. A motorway, a highway, has a long-term geopolitical and also commercial viability for our country. I was going to say something else as well, but also unemployment. A lot of the people that are registered in Kosovo, they live abroad. So 45% unemployment rate, even though
I agree. Now it's lower. I was describing 2008. Now it's also because of methodological changes in
Kosovo. Exactly. It's
not lower. 45%. Absolutely.
It's still high, but absolutely. It's much lower.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. I felt, obviously, given the nature of what you'd said, that it was only fair that there was a right
shall
to reply.
Okay.
I tell you what, I'm going to take actually just because we have quite a lot of questions. I'm
very
going
good,
to ask people, please try and keep questions relatively short. Eric.
I'll be short. Thank you, James. Basically, what you've done is, in a variety of ways, you've given us illustrations as to why, if you give a whole lot of money to people who cannot be trusted, it doesn't improve conditions. So my two questions for you are, first, did anybody expect anything different? And second, can the people who are giving the money be trusted?
Right, okay. Lady at the back there.
Just one quick question. Thank you for your presentation first. He outlined many structural and process-related reasons for the failure of the mission. Do you think, or what would you, what role would you assign to traditions, beliefs, ideas, and do you think that institutions could be copy-paste from one country to another?
Okay, thank you. Mia.
Just a sort of an observation and a question following on from that. I worked quite closely with the EU planning team in 2007, and it genuinely was trying to learn the lessons from Munich. And it was trying to engage with civil society, both in the whole of the EU and in the region as well. And it had a lot of seminars in Brussels and in Pristina and so on. This was becoming a genuine engagement, and unfortunately, when it deployed, that ended up as a strategic communications exercise rather than engagement. And the power that the civil society voices had almost been given was taken away from them. So there was a small attempt to learn the lessons from Munich, which then failed. And then following on from that, I wonder, Andrea, if you could comment on the politicisation of EULEX, and where justice was not done, justice was bound up and chained. I guess you can't give any specific examples, but could you elaborate a little bit on how politicised EULEX?
I'm going to take two more questions and we'll just bundle everything together.
Okay, very good.
Gentleman at the back there.
Yes, thank you very much. My name's Ewan Grant. I'm a former UK Customs Intelligence Analyst for Transnational Organised Crime in the ex-Soviet Union. I've never worked in Kosovo. I've worked with people who were there. 3.5 years in Bosnia with an EU mission, and then 2 years in the first stages of the EU border assistance mission in Moldova and Ukraine. I'm based in Kiev. My question is, do you believe that the European Commission can step up to the plate in Kosovo or in Ukraine and really get reasonable results? I will just say I have never heard a more accurate and honest presentation on either region than I've heard from you today, because I can assure the entire audience, from what I have seen and what I have heard, but certainly from what I've seen, these Brussels has an awful lot of questions to answer, including corruption within Brussels. And I hope a British parliamentary committee can ask Baroness Ashton an awful lot of very, very pregnant questions. They really don't have a clue.
Thank you very much. Antenna.
Yes, thank you indeed, Andrea, for this great presentation. So I singled out two issues which seem to me crucial for your presentation in terms of the problems that we're facing in Kosovo. So the first one is when you talk about the main original sin of EULEX and of the West being not the failure to disarm the elite, the military elite in Kosovo. So I find this quite significant, and I think that's also probably something that can be applied to other countries in the region in terms of certain dynamics being, well, copy-pasted or somehow taken from before the transition to after transition. So my question is, if this was the sin in Kosovo, what do you think we should, are there any lessons learned for Ukraine in this case? The second issue that I find really significant is the aspect of the fake stability that you mentioned, so of the stable weakness of the outward stability on one hand, but on the not actually health of institutions inside, which is something that suits both the West on one hand, because it looks like they got the job done, and the elites internally. There's another aspect to that I find significant. The fact that this has, in a way, impact also on the reaction of the people themselves. I mean, something that that Kosovars, for instance, are very proud of touching, and something that in Montenegro can see, for instance, that they're proud of their own leaders. And this is something that perhaps impacts the perceptions, and this is probably one indicator that we might get wrong, because the European Stability Initiative recently has mentioned that the Kosovo militia, so the military, is perceived to be much less corrupt by customers than German perceived their own military. So their title was Germany is more corrupt than customer. So my, you know, the thing that I was throwing in here is how to, you know, sort of deal these perceptions too.
Thank you very much. Rather a lot of questions there, but we are running out of time.
Yeah,
so
I'll try to be quick. A couple of comments on the comments I received from the gentleman from the Kosovo embassy. As to the merits of the intervention, as I said, my own analysis is neutral to that. Whether it's immaterial for my purposes and for I think for the analysis whether those were good or bad decisions. Independence was contested, indeed, it was contested. By the way, I am convinced that Kosovo now is a sovereign and independent state, full stop, because this has happened. So that is not in question. The question of the similarity with Ukraine is a complex discussion, but I would not go into it, because what interests me is only the fact that someone has used that parallel for good or for bad reasons, legitimate or illegitimate. Putin has said, I do in Ukraine what you did in Kosovo. Whether this is true or not is beside the point, in a way. I fully agree that corruption is high throughout the region. And the problems of Kosovo, I should have said that, in fact, the problems I described in Kosovo are well within the same order of magnitude of similar problems elsewhere in the region. Kosovo does not stand out in the book. I think that Kosovo is more problematic. I mean, Kosovo, let me rephrase it, Kosovo suffers greater problems than the rest of the Balkans because I think that the elite of Kosovo has greater concentration of power, is more homogenous, and relies on a more solid and more inefficient and more unfair governance system. Having said this, the problems are very similar to those of the rest of the region. I will not say, okay, the highway, your view is that it has geopolitical importance. I take note of that. Could we expect Kosovo to do better with the aid they received? I think yes. The theories I described say, in where governance is bad, in order for aid to be beneficial and not detrimental to governance, you need to enter into a kind of political commitment by the recipient with the donor, so that the donor can check exactly what you do with that aid. In a way, the deployment of my own mission, and in particular my own unit, and also ULEX, were a sort of huge governance guarantee over this flow of aid. The international community, as I said, it was. I think the intervention was well designed because a lot of aid came into Kosovo, but also with a governance instrument to make sure, in principle, that aid was not diverted. It didn't happen because we didn't do our job. But I think conceivably, at least, it was possible. Culture. I devote quite a few pages to arguing that culture is not at the roots of Kosovo's governance problems. The moral legacy of Kosovo's history, its traditions, its culture, etc., are not the cause of its current governance problems. There is very interesting literature, including by Amartya Sen, on the importance of culture in these governance issues. I don't find it a very persuasive explanation, but it is a widespread idea. Among my colleagues in Kosovo and among UN peacekeepers, I often heard the expression, what can you achieve? These people, you know, simply lack the culture. Some people were saying, well, the same missions that were breaching the democratic principles were saying, well, but these people are unable to govern themselves according to democratic standards, to international standards. You know, it is also a self-serving explanation, because if Kosovo's problems are rooted in its culture, then it was impossible to do anything about it. So no blame can be laid at the feet of the two missions. Whereas I think that culture and traditions had a role in giving a certain shape or color, if you like, to the inefficient governance system that arose in Kosovo. But its real origins, I think, are the power and the interests of the elite, and also maybe also distorted ideas. Not vested interests do not always explain everything, but they explain a lot. And the predatory instincts of the elite of Kosovo are rather significant. Their power is very strong, and you don't need to use culture to explain what happened in Kosovo. Copy-paste institutions, of course. There is a wealth of literature in institutional economics and development studies that tells you that this is senseless. This is what I was referring to when I talked of constitutional engineering. If you take the Swedish competition law and translate it into Albanian and put it into the law books of Kosovo, you will not achieve anything. Because Danny Roderick, for instance, has written a lot about second-best institutions. You need to build or to develop the institutions that are fitting in your existing governance context, in your existing social order. Otherwise, underlying forces will distort those institutions, and you may end up paradoxically worse off than if you hadn't adopted the Swedish model. Politicization of ULEX. Just one example. Well, ULEX, I think, managed to, over 6 years, managed to convict two slightly prominent political figures for corruption. I quote in the book a consultant who worked on municipal procurement. I think in 2010 he said, every contract I analyze was tainted by corruption, and municipal officials told me that, likewise, everything that they did was influenced by corruption. This was municipal level. Maybe the state level is corruption is less widespread. I don't know, but ULEX, in a country where corruption is very widespread, ULEX achieved only two slightly relevant, significant convictions for corruption. Was it only incompetence or failure to find the evidence that explains these very poor results? I don't think so. I myself sent to ULEX official documents strongly suggesting that corruption was involved in a few transactions I happened to learn about because of my official duties. In these cases, if corruption was involved, it was highly likely, if not even nearly certain, that high political figures were involved. In each of these cases, despite receiving from me the official papers, ULEX did nothing. They did not open any investigation, including on the highway. I think the highway cost 25% of GDP. Per kilometer, the highway cost 2.5 times the average per kilometer cost in Germany, even though the level of prices in Kosovo and the cost of labor is a fraction of that in Germany. I think corruption explains a part of the difference between German's prices and Kosovo's prices. ULEX did not open any investigation on this case, which, if corruption was involved, resulted in the diversion of something, well, as much as maybe 10% of GDP into bribes or extra market profits for the builders of the highway. This, of course, is all speculation. I think this is a plausible explanation for these numbers. But the fact that ULEX did not open an investigation suggests that they were convinced that there was no corruption, and that's it. But anyone can reach their own conclusions about this. How can the European Union improve its performance? Well, that's a very big question. I think improving accountability within the machinery of the foreign policy of the EU would go a long way to improving its performance. I don't think the foreign policy of the EU can improve fundamentally, including in its state-building operations, until the foreign policy of the EU remains an intergovernmentalist enterprise. And I think it will remain an intergovernmentalist enterprise until there is no form of political union within Europe. Because only a more genuine political union would be able to assign to its foreign policy with sufficient internal and external credibility interests to pursue and objectives to pursue. Still, even within this current intergovernmentalist framework, I think that strengthening accountability inside the machinery of the foreign policy in Brussels would go a long way to improving performance. You said that the population in Kosovo is proud of Tachi. Tachi is the former prime minister of Kosovo, was prime minister for 7 years. Indeed, the elite of Kosovo keeps getting votes. Approximately 45% of the population of the electorate votes. And parties linked to the elite receive the vast majority of the votes. Yet, I think, at the same time, some 70, 75, 80% of the population declares itself ready to protest for either economic or political reasons. There seems to be a contradiction between these two facts. I think we see here, on one hand, the effect of... we see the incentives, the result of the incentives of the governance system I just described. It is individually rational for the ordinary citizen to accept this system, yet at the same time they see that this system deprives them of political and economic opportunities. Let me, to conclude, tell you why between November and early February, thousands of people left Kosovo to migrate illegally, generally, into the European Union, crossing Serbia and going into Hungary, mainly to reach, presumably, Germany or Austria or Switzerland. The numbers are uncertain, but the European Commission recently wrote a report which uses an estimate of, I think, 90,000 people. 90,000 people may not sound much, but this is 5% of the population of Kosovo. 5% of the population of Kosovo left their country in peacetime in the space of 10, 12 weeks. This, I think, is a comment on the quality of life and of the quality of the political and economic system that exists now in Kosovo. I would add that the few comments I read about this were ascribing this exodus, as it has been called, to dissatisfaction for the socio-economic conditions of Kosovo, which indeed are lamentable. But the socio-economic conditions of Kosovo were bad last year and the year before and the previous year. And in fact, in some way, they have been improving. As you can see, there was growth in Kosovo, 4%. It's not nothing. I think these people left, 5% of the population left Kosovo, because there was a political stalemate between elections held in June 2014 and December. And there were two groupings that were fighting for taking the government. One of the two groupings included a new party, which, I don't want to take a position on this party, but it is quite vocal in its desire to reform the governance system of Kosovo and in denouncing the corruption of the current elite. It is plausible that, and this party had joined up with two parties, in fact, that belonged de facto to the existing elite of Kosovo. In the end, the stalemate was solved when the elite, in fact, closed ranks and left this new party into opposition. And the two parties that alternated themselves in the government of Kosovo since the early 2000s now formed a coalition government together. I think this 5% of the population left exactly after this coalition agreement was made because I think they lost hope that their political system would be not only able but also willing to try to do something about improving the socio-economic conditions of Kosovo. I think they simply lost trust in their political system. This is why they left at that moment.
I think, unfortunately, we really are out of time. But there is wine here. So anyone who would like to say, stay and ask Andrea further questions. And I know that there were a number, I'm very sorry, there were much more questions than I could possibly hope to take, is obviously welcome to stay. Welcome to stay and join us for a drink. So on that note, I'd like to thank Andrea enormously for coming along and for presenting this book. And I think as a final important note, there are obviously copies for sale here at a very good knockdown rate. So grab them while they're hot. Thank you very much.
Thank you.